ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। रीडिंग फ्रॉम श्रीमद् भगवद् गीता चैप्टर 14 एंटाइटल द थ्री मोड्स ऑफ मटेरियल नेचर टेक्स्ट 3 एंड 4। विल रीड टेक्स्ट 3 फर्स्ट। मम योनिर्महद्ब्रह्म तस्मिन् गर्भं ददाम्यहम् संभवः सर्वभूतानां ततो भवति भारत। परपट बाय हिज डिवाइन ग्रेस एसी भक्तिवेदांत स्वामी श्रील प्रभुपाद। द टोटल मटेरियल सब्सटेंस कॉल्ड ब्रह्मन इज अ सोर्स ऑफ बर्थ एंड इट इज दैट ब्रह्मन दैट आई इम्प्रेग्नेट making possible the births of all living beings, O son of Bharata. Purport. This is an explanation of the world. Everything that takes place is due to the combination of Kshetra and Kshetrajna, the body and the spirit soul. This combination of material nature and the living entity is made possible by the Supreme God Himself. The Mahat Tattva is the total cause of the total cosmic manifestation. And that total substance of the material cause, in which there are three modes of nature, is sometimes called the Brahman. The Supreme Personality impregnates the total substance, and thus innumerable universes become possible. This total material substance, the Mahat Tattva, is described as Brahman in the Vedic literature, the Mundaka Upanishads. Tasmad eta Brahma, nama rupam anam cha jayet. The Supreme Personal impregnates that Brahman with the seeds of the living entities. The 24 elements, beginning from earth, water, fire and air, are all material energy. And they constitute what is called Mahat Brahma, or the great Brahman. The material nature, as explained in the 7th chapter, beyond this, there is another superior nature, the living entity. Into material nature, the superior nature is mixed by the will of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And thereafter, all living entities are born of this material nature. The scorpion lays its eggs in piles of rice. And sometimes it is said that the scorpion is born out of rice. But the rice is not the cause of the scorpion. Actually, the eggs were laid by the mother. Similarly, material nature is not the cause of the birth of the living entities. The seed is given by the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And they only seem to come out as products of material nature. Thus, every living entity, according to its past activities, has a different body created by this material nature, so that the entity can enjoy or suffer according to his past deeds. The Lord is the cause of the manifestations of the living entities in this material world. Homagyan Hare Krishna. Today we'll be reading the third and the fourth verse. So I'll just read quickly the fourth verse, which is one of the very prominent and important verses of the Gita. Quickly. Sarva yonishu kaunteya murtya sambhavantiyah tasam brahma mahadyonir aham bija pradapita. Translation. It should be understood that all species of life, O son of Kunti, are made possible by birth in this material nature. And that I am the seed-giving father. Purport. In this verse, it is clearly explained that the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Krishna, is the original father of all living entities. The living entities are combinations of the material nature and the spiritual nature. Such living entities are seen not only on this planet, but on every planet, even on the highest where Brahma is situated. Everywhere there are living entities. Within the earth, there are living entities. Even within water and within fire. All these appearances are due to the mother, material nature, and Krishna's seed-giving process. The purport is that the material world is impregnated with living entities who come out in various forms at the time of creation according to their past deeds. Hare Krishna. So we are in a very interesting section of the Gita, where Krishna is talking about probably one of the most interesting and complicated section parts of philosophy, parts of the philosophy. Basically, he's talking about the three modes of material nature here, and there are a lot of things involved. Let's try to simplify it and try to understand this. So the first point that Srila Prabhupada is making in the purport is that everything takes place due to the combination of body and spirit. This is the Bhagavad Gita understanding of creation. Nothing happens by chance, but things take place by combination of body and spirit. And without spirit, nothing can act. Like if you analyze everything in this world, nothing practically happens without the intervention of the spirit. Like say, for example, this small carving of carpentry. You can say, where is the spirit in this? You know, where is, it seems to be matter. There's no spirit in it. So how can we say that spirit is involved in shaping this or in creating this? But the fact is that this table will not exist unless a spirit soul, a carpenter, intervenes and carves it. Similarly, in every aspect of life, spirit has to be involved for things to happen. For example, a car, for the car to move, there has to be a driver, a living entity, and without which there can't be movement also. Or for example, if you take a person who is living, when he's living, the body is intact and you know all the cells are working. But the moment the person dies, immediately the process of decay starts. We see so many dogs roaming around in the streets. All of them are healthy. They don't have any problems. But the moment the dog dies, you see within a few days, it starts shrinking and it practically disappears. So the decay starts when the spirit leaves. So this combination of body and spirit has to be together. That's a concept that the Bhagavad Gita teaches us. We have to learn to accept the existence of the spirit soul. And for example, if you take an apple and you bite it, till the time it is bitten, the process of decay doesn't begin. But the moment the apple is bitten, it starts becoming blackish. The decay starts. So again, the intervention of the spirit. So in Bhagavad Gita, the technical term that is used to understand the study of matter and spirit is called Sankhya Yoga. Sankhya Yoga. And that is what basically the modern science is composed of. Study of matter and living entities associated with matter. And interestingly, Bhagavad Gita has a terminology for such study. It may be shocking to some people who are of scientific background, but the Bhagavad Gita calls this study to be Sankhya Yoga Prithak Balaha. Bala means child. Bhagavad Gita says that this knowledge or this study of matter and spirit together, this kind of analysis of the living entities, is meant for Bala. That means for children. So actually Bhagavad Gita doesn't give a very high rating for this kind of study. And in fact, Krishna, he talks about two levels of study. He talks about the study of spirit and matter, what we're talking about just now. And he talks about the higher study of spirit and God. So most people try to study the combination of spirit and matter very deeply. And without entering into the study of spirit and God. So unless we learn to study both, you can't see the connection of God. So when you study matter and spirit, there is no God in between. And when you study spirit and God, there is no matter. So it has to be a combination of the three. It's called the combination of spirit, matter and God. So that's why Krishna, if you analyze the Gita, if you study it properly, there is a verse where Krishna talks about how everything that is existing in this world is existing as if pearls are strung on a thread. And that invisible thread is Krishna. So in the study of this world, if you do not study God along, then you will not see the string. You will just see that pearls are there, But you'll not see that there is a connection of a string in between all the pearls. That's the beauty of studying all the three, matter, spirit and God. Just like there is a very beautiful example, I was just thinking about this. There are nowadays many game shows in the television. You know, talk about game shows. Interestingly, every living entity likes to play games. If you see a child, the child likes to play with toys. If you see a teenager, a young boy, he tries to play with sports or with some video games. If you see people who are little more elder, they like to play with life. You know, many people you see, I was just watching a video on mountain climbing, you know. Practically, there is no place to keep your leg nor your hand. So they use these, you know, steel rods to climb on mountains. And they wear steel-framed footwear. So practically, they are not holding anything, nor is the leg balanced on anything. So they are just practically hanging on air. But people enjoy this kind of a sport, this kind of games. That gives them some kind of kick. And if you see that even sadhus, even people who are saintly, they are also playing a certain game. And that game is a very, very subtle game. This is a game of life. Because they consider the whole life, our whole, you know, duration of life to be like a game. Where you have a choice whether to win the game or lose the game. And most people don't even understand that life is a game. Right? So this is, unless you delve into the knowledge of the Gita and try to understand what the Gita is trying to tell us, we'll not even understand that we are a part of a game. A live video game. Where you get to choose at every stage of your life what you want to do ahead. But once you make a choice, you don't get to re-choose. Life is full of choices. It gives you choice after choice after choice after choice. Till practically the end of life. And if you make the right choices, you go to the next level. And if you make the wrong choices, you come back. This is the game of life. There is a very interesting purport where Prabhupada mentions a very nice, interesting line. I wanted to read out this and we can probably understand things better. He says, it's a tough line, so kindly pay attention. He says, the spiritual quality of the seer is manifest in our dissatisfaction with the limited state of material conditioned existence. I'll repeat it. The spiritual quality of the seer is manifested in our dissatisfaction with the limited state of materially conditioned existence. He says that is the difference between matter and spirit. Very interesting. If you analyze it, what this sentence means is that the spiritual quality of the seer, that means a person who is trying to see his different aspects of life, is actually seen, is manifested with the dissatisfaction with the limited state of material conditioned existence. That means anybody who is actually living in this world, when he's trying to enjoy things of this world, he's always dissatisfied. He always finds a limitation. He always finds something missing. So all of us are the seer. All of us are seeking for this happiness in life. But unless we allow God to intervene in our life, we will never get the satisfaction that we are looking from life. Right? So, there is a nice sentence which says, introspection is the beginning of spiritual life. That's why the first aphorism of the Vedanta Sutra is, Atato Brahma Jigyasa. So, unless you start introspecting, till then, there is no question of progress. Or there is no question of change in life. Most of us in this world today are so much in a hurry to do things, so much in a hurry to get things done, that we don't have the time, nor the energy, nor the desire to stop and introspect. And introspection is the quality that is most desirable for somebody who has intelligence. You having intelligence, but having no introspection is practically having no intelligence. Right?
You have your intelligence, but you do not use the intelligence to understand what is right and wrong. That's actually having no intelligence. If God has given us the intelligence and the ability, let us use it and try to introspect and understand what God is teaching us through the Gita. And actually when we worship God, when we serve God, I mean, most people may say, this is so boring, you know. If you analyze our worship of God, the same deities we see every day. Krishna does not even change his position. He doesn't change his posture. Practically same person. But the fact is that, if you go to South India, you see Srirangam, Ranganath Swami is lying down. He doesn't change his position. He's not standing up one day, lying down one day, sitting one day. He's always lying down. Here Gopinath is always standing. But the fact is that, in spite of consistency or in spite of non-variety, there is satisfaction. So it's not that Krishna has to do something different to attract people. Or Krishna has to, do something different to keep attention of everyone. Just Krishna being there captivates our attention. It keeps us satisfied. Similarly, the books that we read about the Lord, or the knowledge that we read given by the Lord, give us the same amount of satisfaction, though it is read every time. You read the same Gita today, you read it 10 years down the line. The same message of the Gita will apply and will actually transform your life in a different way. And especially in a way that you need the most. So that's why we say that Krishna is a person. And Krishna's knowledge is also personal. So if Krishna is a person and his knowledge is personal, then it has to touch us in a personal way. Each of us have to be touched by that knowledge in a very personal way. Otherwise, how are we going to relate to it? Otherwise, how are we going to think it is for us? Right? So that's the speciality of the Gita. And as far as the freshness, as far as the aspect of Krishna being always satisfying, it's amazing. I was just thinking about this point, that whatever Krishna does, people always glorify him. Have you ever heard of a wife glorifying a husband or glorifying a person who has just killed her husband? I mean, it's impossible. If somebody, especially, somebody is killing your husband, for women, for a husband to be killed, it's like the most painful thing. People would commit sati. Women would enter the fire because they wouldn't be able to tolerate the pain of separation. The pain of the burning fire is cooler for them than the pain of separation from the husband. But here, where we analyze these three personalities, Vali, Ravan and Duryodhan, when all these three personalities were killed, when all these three personalities died, their wife actually glorified the Lord. Actually thanked the Lord. If you see the story of Mandodari, when Ravana died, Ravana was killed by Lord Ram, Mandodari, the wife of Ravan, she was not lamenting so much that my husband died. She was lamenting more that my husband died pursuing the wrong cause. She was lamenting so much my husband died not listening to the advice of the saintly persons. There's a list of 13 different personalities who spoke to Ravan and told him not to continue this. Return back Sita. They told him that this is the most dangerous thing for you. They told him that Ram is God. 13 different personalities at different stages. But every time, Ravan just turned a blind eye. So Mandodari was not so much lamenting that my husband died. But she was lamenting that my husband died pursuing the wrong cause. Similarly, if you see the life of Duryodhan. When Duryodhan is killed after the battle of Kurukshetra, his wife, Bhanumati, she was not lamenting that my husband died. But she was lamenting that he actually died such a negative and evil death. that nobody is going to ever remember him for what he was. People will remember him for what he should not, no one should be. He represented what you should not be, rather than representing what you should be. So for us, when we analyze these personalities, we understand that in spite of God committing something bad in their life, but still they glorified God. Like when Vali was killed in front of Tara, her husband was killed in front of her by Lord Ram. And that too in a very diplomatic way. He was hiding and killing her, killing Vali. But in spite of that, Tara, when she looks at Lord Ram, she glorifies the eyes of Lord Ram. She says that the eyes of Lord Ram is reddish in color. And she tells, she's asking, why is the eye of the Lord reddish in color? Generally, when somebody is crying, his eye becomes red. But Ram has no reason to cry. I mean, why will he cry that Vali has died? He's not crying. Nor is he too joyful. Because how can he be too joyful that he has killed somebody? So these are not the reasons that Lord Ram's eyes are red. Tara, very interesting, she says that Lord Ram's eyes are red because of lack of sleep. Because the Lord is so much interested in taking care of his devotees, in seeing the welfare of his devotees, that he doesn't sleep. He's always thinking of how my devotee is in danger. How can I protect him? How can I give him more? So because of that, so can you imagine that somebody whose husband has died is talking about the glory of another person? That's how the Lord is. So, and as far as the books of the Lord, and another point, in the Ramayana we see that Ram is penniless when he is walking in the forest of Dandakaranya in Chitragod, when he is fighting the war with Ravan. He doesn't have any money. He is penniless. He is no more the king of Ayodhya. He is no more the prince. He is just an ordinary person in the hermitage. But still, all these monkeys were willing to serve the Lord. Where do you find people willing to serve somebody when they're not getting anything from that person? Ram never assured them that after I win the war, I'll give you so much money. There was no contract like that. The only contract was the contract of love. So all these vanaras, they gave their loyalty to the Lord because they were so much attracted by the beauty of Lord Ram. They were so much attracted and they were so much satisfied rendering service to the Lord. And not only the Lord, but the Lord's things or anything connected to the Lord is as attractive even now. I would like to narrate one or two stories of people whose lives have been transformed by being attracted to the books of the Lord. Like for example, in one country, one man was driving his car and suddenly his car went over something. Generally in India, if a car goes over something, you don't care because there are so many things on the road. But in the West, if the car goes over something, that's like a phenomena because nothing is there on the road. So he got down and he went to see what was there. And he found a Krishna book. So he had driven over a Krishna book because somebody had thrown it. And then he picked it up, brought it home. And then he read it. And after reading it, he was so much transformed, he was so much joyful that he actually went on to find a temple where he could associate with devotees and take up this process seriously. There are many other stories like that. There was a person, like when devotees go out for distributing books, this is the month of marathon, devotees go out to distribute the Gita, distribute the Krishna book in a large number. But then, it's not just an endeavor, it's not a work for them. It's a very joyful process. The process of giving Krishna to anybody is the process of joy. You're not just giving a book, but you're giving the Supreme Personality of Godhead to that person. So when you give Krishna or you take Krishna, it creates joy in your heart. Because Krishna is joyful. Krishna is Rasaraj, the reservoir of pleasure. So when somebody is involved in this process of giving and taking Krishna, they naturally experience a lot of joy in the heart. So there was a carpenter in one temple and he was carving something and suddenly he saw devotees coming back from Sankirtan, coming back from distributing books of Prabhupada, distributing the Gita. And when he saw their faces, he saw there was so much joy, so much happiness in them. He wanted to know what they did, what they were doing to experience this joy. He said, I've gone to all the pubs. When I come back from the pub, I'm not joyful, but I'm miserable. I've gone to all the sports fields, but when I come back, I'm not this joyful. So he wanted to know from them, what is that thing that is giving them so much joy and happiness? And then he came to know that these people went and they were distributing Gitas on the road. It's a hard labor, hard effort. But then they were so joyful. And he wanted to experience the same joy. So the next day he went along with them to distribute books. Ordinary carpenter with no connection with God. But when he came back, he was again experiencing the same joy. So then he decided that this is what is actually giving us supreme joy. So this is something that we have to learn. Associate and take shelter of this knowledge and of Krishna. And the next point that Krishna makes, Prabhupada makes in this purport is that material nature is our mother and Krishna is our father. Very interesting thing, this concept of mother and father. There's another example that is given here. It seems that when you have a rice bag, suddenly you see sometimes scorpions coming out of the bag, out of rice. Or some other insects for that matter. But when you see these insects coming out, do we think that rice has produced these insects? No. We know for sure that there were some eggs in it, and the eggs grew to become insects. We don't think that rice is producing scorpion or rice is producing some insect. We know for sure that these have come out because of some egg. Similarly, when it comes to Krishna, when it comes to God, we know for sure if we are here, the very fact that we are here, the fact is that Krishna or God has created us. And so where does the chance theory come in picture? Many people say that by chance we have come about, or by combination of chemicals we have come about, or from monkeys we have come about. Whatever the fact may be, but the fact is that, and Krishna is vouching for that, he says that I am the seed-giving father. And when he says I am the seed-giving father, the next question comes. If he is a father, why has he abandoned us? Why has he left us away? The understanding is that, again, coming back to this example of mountain climbing, there is a nice video of two people climbing a huge mountain, which is the most dangerous one, and they're climbing it slowly. And the mechanism that they use to be in touch with each other is they tie a rope to each other, just to make sure, because they have very less resources, and the resources are shared among each other. They have a bag. Somebody carries something, somebody carries something else. So they need each other to support, and there is nobody else except snow. So they decide to stay together by tying a rope. So one person climbs up, the other person is following. But the interesting part is that, so at one point of time, it so happens that the person below slips and he is falling. And after a certain amount of time, the rope holds him. Because there's a man on top, he's tied a rope to his waist, and there's a man hanging based on that rope. So can you imagine the kind of pressure that is there on the man on top? So he's trying to pull the person who is below above. He's trying to pull him back. Not just because he wants to save him, but it's just because the pressure on his waist is too much to hold him. And then when he realizes that at a certain point of time, it's too much to hold on more, he snaps the rope. Not because he doesn't want to save him, but because he is going to be affected. So God more or less plays the role of a person who is on top. He wants to hold us, but we are too adamant that we don't want to be held by him. We're too adamant that we want to run away from him. So how can possibly a person hold you when you want to run away from him? And how long can he hold you for? So then Krishna leaves us. And then we come here to this material world. But the interesting thing is, Krishna is no more like this man with the rope. Krishna sends some support, some help, some intervention in our lives. There is a very interesting understanding that living entities are always moving around in this world. Especially if we see it from the Vedic point of view, living entities are moving within the universes. one living entity, depending on his karma, depending on his values and the kind of elevation that he's getting in his life, he gets a chance to even go to the higher worlds. He gets a chance to even go to the spiritual world. But then, the interesting phenomena is that there are some people from the spiritual world come down. So there's a crisscross. So some living entity is going to the spiritual world and some living entity is coming from the spiritual world to the earth. So out of the living entities who come from the spiritual world to the earth, there are two types. One is somebody who is forced to go to the earth to suffer. But the other is somebody who comes to the earth out of his own choice. Not because he has to suffer, but he wants to relieve suffering. So that's the intervention of God. So God not just leaves us in this world to suffer, but he provides support in the form of his best companions. He sends his best people down to the earth to help us. That's the role of the spiritual master. That's the role of guru. So there are guides who come. There are guides who come to this earth to help us to go back. There are guides who come to this earth to help us to be reconnected with the rope to God. And not only that, Krishna also sends his message along. Just like God is a person, as I was telling, his message is a person. And his message is not just a person without a heart. His message is a person with a throbbing heart. And Krishna, the book or the message of God, is actually potent and perfect to actually give us the perfection that we desire in our life. And God's message, the Gita or any of the words of God, have the potency to actually elevate each of us in our lives. And God is actually not like a strict master. Many times in the Semitic faith, there is a conception that God is strict. He's a very heavy master. But the fact is that God is a very merciful master. And God is the most selfless person. If God was selfish, generally if somebody has wealth, if somebody has beauty, if somebody has anything in this world, he doesn't want to share the best of what he has with others. He will want to hold back. He will want to retain something with himself. But God is not like that. If you analyze God, the quality of God is that he shares with us the best of what he has. Beauty. If you think that God is beautiful, but he wants to make, if he was envious, if he was jealous of all of us, he would have never sent any kind of beauty to this earth. He would have retained all beauty with him. But the fact is that God is so magnanimous to the extent he gives his own form. He gives his own appearance to his devotees. Many of the devotees of the Lord, who are especially in the spiritual world, look just like God. Many people want to look like God. Many people want to be God. But the fact is that they look so ugly. But Krishna is so magnanimous, but that to somebody who is really surrendered to him, somebody who has really put faith in him, and somebody who really wants to serve him, he gives him the best of what he has. That's why the description comes in the Srimad Bhagavatam, where the son of Krishna, Aniruddha and Pradyumna, they look exactly like Krishna in terms of beauty, in terms of intelligence, in terms of everything. Krishna gives them everything. And when they come back to the city of Dwarka, when the citizens look at Pradyumna or Aniruddha entering the city of Dwarka, they're so fascinated because they think that Krishna is entering. Because they look practically same. So if you compare the son of Krishna, Aniruddha, Pradyumna, with all of us who are also sons of Krishna, the fact is that Krishna wants to give all of us godly qualities. But the point is, how much of us want to experience and absorb those godly qualities? So to the degree we accept godly qualities, to the degree we practice godly qualities, those qualities actually start manifesting in us. If we stay away from godly qualities, then they don't manifest in us. So Krishna, the point is that Krishna is so merciful, so magnanimous, that he's ready to share the best of what he has with us. So, And because God has manifested the best of what He has in this earth, we find devotees of God acting so magnanimous, manifesting so glorious qualities like forgiveness, tolerance, and so many other good qualities. And the next point that comes in this particular chapter specifically is the three modes of material nature. I was telling that this is a very interesting but a very intricate part of the Gita. And the conclusion of the Gita is what we have to understand of these three modes of material nature. Though there are the mode of goodness, the mode of passion, and the mode of ignorance, and the best, of course, is the mode of goodness, but Gita doesn't end with only talking about the three modes and talking about which is the best. It tells us to transcend these three modes. Right? The quality of sattva or the quality of goodness is manifested in somebody who has knowledge, who seeks knowledge. So, somebody who has knowledge is considered to be in the mode of goodness. But unfortunately, the defect or the problem with the mode of goodness is that even if you have knowledge, even if you have the mode of goodness, it makes you proud that I have knowledge, that I know things. That when a tree is, when a tree is laden with fruits, it bends down. So similarly, somebody who has knowledge has to be humble. If the fruits of knowledge doesn't make you humble, then they're not actually real fruits. Just like in a tree which is laden with fruits, naturally because of the weight of the fruits, the tree bends down. But if the tree has, useless fruits, this tree stands upright. It doesn't bend down with the weight. So similarly, when knowledge manifests in us, and especially the knowledge that is actually transformative, when it manifests in us, we become humble. So there are two qualities, Radhanath Swami Maharaj is mentioning in one lecture, that both the qualities are transformative. Pride is transformative and humility is transformative. But both humility and pride transform in opposite directions. Humility makes you selfless. Humility makes you noble. But pride makes you arrogant. Pride makes you selfish. Right? So even if somebody is in sattva guna, but still, that's not the end. You have to transcend it. Just like being in the mode of goodness or having sattva guna is like having the facility to go to the airport and having a ticket, of course. But once you enter the airport, unless you sit in the plane and actually the plane takes off, there is no use of coming to the airport. There is no use of the endeavor of coming to the airport. So coming to the mode of goodness is coming to the airport. But transcending the mode of goodness and actually going to the mode of pure goodness, or actually going to the mode of transcendental worship of the Lord, you can't take off. Your plane is stagnant. And what to speak of passion and ignorance, which are much lower. So the quality of passion, the quality of Rajagun is represented by two things: hankering and attachment. Trishna means hankering, and Sangha means attachment. So when these two qualities manifest in somebody, then the quality of passion is prominent in that person. And the scriptures talk about the life of Ravan, where Ravan represents the mode of passion. He had everything in somebody would want, but he always had a hankering for something that he didn't have. Like when Surpanaka, his sister, came to him and described the beauty of Sita, that description was enough to generate the hankering in him for Sita. It's like a child. A child, it's very easy to instigate a child to want something. You have to just glorify that thing. The moment you glorify that object, the child wants it, no matter what. No matter how many toys he has, no matter how many things he has, but still, because he has heard the glory of something, he develops the hankering. So Ravana is like that child who has everything, who has Mandodari, who is practically a replica of Sita in one sense. practically looks like the goddess of fortune. Very beautiful. But still, he hankers for something that he doesn't have. And so many, as I was telling, so many people gave him so many warnings, but still, he never listened to any of them. And not just warnings, hearing is first class. If somebody hears and understands, that's first class intelligence. But somebody who doesn't hear, he sees others. You know, he sees something happening and then he understands. That's second class. But somebody who hears, who sees, and even experiences, and then he changes, that's third class. But somebody who even after experience does not understand and does not change is really low class. So Ravan was very, very low class in his intelligence, though he was practically like Brihaspati, who had all the knowledge of the Vedas. But still, the Vedic knowledge had no transformation in his heart. And it didn't make any relevance in his life. So Ravana, in spite of practical experiences, never changed. And Hanuman, at so many times during the war, during the battle of Ramayana, at so many instances, he tried to intervene in, you know, and he created so much havoc. Even before the war, he entered the palace of Ravana, destroyed the entire palace, practically burning. But in spite of that, it didn't strike to Ravan that maybe if one monkey could create so much havoc, what will happen when hundreds and thousands of monkeys come? He never realized that. That's lack of intelligence. And the third one is Tamagun, or the mode of ignorance, which is represented by Kumbhakaran. And Kumbhakaran was the brother of Ravan. He had a benediction. He could get any benediction from Brahma, but he chose to sleep for 365 days. And it took 10,000 people to just wake him up. So he represented the mode of ignorance. So people who are in the mode of ignorance, like intoxication and sleep a lot. So Ravan represents nasty people, you know. And in this world, nasty people are there at every step in our lives. In a city or in a village, the local gunda of the village is like the nasty person. Or in a city, hafta, you know, people collect bribes, people collect, some kind of hafta. So those people are considered to be the nasty people. Or higher, in a level of the nation, people like, you know, the corrupt politicians, or if you see the scriptures, King Vena was like a national level nasty person, you know. He terrorized the entire nation practically. So people are scared of him, the entire nation. But Ravana and Hiranyakashipu were like universal level nasty. You know, they were universal terrorists. So they represent the mode of passion and ignorance. So the point is, there's a nice interesting story about, in the, you know, when I was telling about this Ravan and the monkeys creating havoc in his life. Hanumanji, there was a very interesting thing, folk tale, which I used to hear in my childhood. You know, very relevant, so I would want to narrate it. So once Hanumanji realized that after the killing of Kumbhakaran, Ravan decided to perform a yagya, sacrifice, to become powerful. And as a result of the end product of the sacrifice, where thousands of rituals were done, he would become like really powerful, nobody would kill him. And then Hanumanji came to know that Ravan is doing such a sacrifice. So what he did? He disguised himself as a Brahmana and went into that sacrificial arena. And there were like hundreds of Brahmanas, you know, performing. And then he with intense amount of energy, he started helping everyone. Collecting the logs of wood, collecting, you know, so many ingredients. And he was like serving very menially. So all the Brahmanas became very impressed with this other Brahmana. So they told him, ask for any benediction. So Hanumanji, who was disguised as a Brahman, he said, the only benediction I want is that at the end of the sacrifice, you change one syllable. So there was a syllable that they chant called Harani. And he said, replace it, H with K. Make it Karani. So that's all I want. When the Brahmanas heard this, they realized what would be the consequence. But of course, Ravan didn't realize it. So they accepted. Though they didn't want to do it, but they accepted. So the end of the whole sacrifice, when the sacrifice was over, they chanted the wrong one, of course. And then nothing happened. So Ravana was shocked that, you know, at the end of this whole sacrifice, so much of endeavor, something should happen now. He expected that, you know, the Mother Kali would come out and give him a weapon or something like that. But nothing happened. And then he realized that the whole endeavor was a waste of time. So Hanumanji kept doing such things, such small, small things, you know. So the point is, when Ravan, being so intelligent and so clever, in spite of understanding all these small signs that defeat is close to him, he never accepted and never acted on that understanding. So the point is, these three modes of material nature are always bind us. They are like three ropes. When three ropes are intertwined together, to cut the rope is tough. To break the rope is tough. So for such a rope to be broken or cut, the only method is to take external help of a sword and cut it. So all these three modes which actually bind us to this world are like these three ropes which actually tie us. And the only thing that we should do is to cut this rope through the weapon of knowledge. And the knowledge is what Krishna is revealing us through these words in the form of the scriptures. So the understanding is that as long as we base our life centered around God, till then a life is considered to be God-centric. A life is considered to be something with some kind of stability. Just like a ball. If you take a ball in this hall and just throw it around, the ball will go without a direction and without guidance. It just go anywhere. You can't control it. It just bounce around. But the same ball, if it is tied to a rope and swing the rope around, you can exactly define the momentum of the ball. You can exactly define the direction of the ball, the orbit of the ball. So similarly, when our life is without a center, without God in the center, it's like this ball, just going anywhere. Or it may be maximum like a clay ball. You know, you take a ball made of clay and you bounce it, it sticks. Especially if it is wet clay, it sticks. So our life is like either the bouncing ball or the clay ball. But it's better that we make our life like the swinging ball with a rope tied around. But the only factor is that rope. So we have to give Krishna the choice to hold that rope. So if you think that in spite of the rope being tied to us, if we still allow the ball to bounce, it'll bounce. But if we give our lives in the hands of God, in the hands of the representatives of God, then our life will actually have some meaning and have a specific direction. And understanding the Gita actually brings us to this understanding that however great we may be, but in spite of our abilities, in spite of our greatness, in spite of our, you know, intelligence, we still in front of God are small, are insignificant. That's why when in this 10th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, when Brahmaji comes to meet Krishna, Krishna is in Dwarka, is sitting in his palace, and Lord Brahma comes and he wants to meet Krishna. And he comes to the door and the doorkeeper asks Brahmaji, you know, who are you? Brahmaji is shocked. Somebody is asking him, who are you? Because nobody asks the president of India, you know, who are you? It's obvious that the president is known. So Brahmaji was shocked that who is this? Who is asking me this question? So then the guard goes inside and asks and tells Krishna. And of course Brahmaji tells, I am Brahma. So guard goes inside and tells Krishna that Brahma has come. So Krishna, understanding the attitude of Brahma, immediately tells the guard to ask him which Brahma. So the Acharyas give a very nice understanding of this word which Krishna uses. Which Brahma? The understanding is that when Krishna is telling Brahmaji, the creator of this universe, which Brahma, that means for Krishna, everyone, however great he may be, is still insignificant. So all of us, we may be Brahmas to a certain extent. We may be the CEO or the Brahma of our company. Or we may be the Brahma of our house. Or we may be the Brahma of our body at least. But still, for Krishna, we are which Brahma? Who are we? We are insignificant. So understanding our position in front of God actually generates humility. And humility generates the thirst for understanding who we really are. Humility leads to knowledge. And knowledge leads to practice based on that knowledge. And practice of the knowledge leads to transformation. Transformation of our heart, transformation of our lifestyles. And transformation of our lifestyle leads to perfection. So when we understand that what our position is and act according to that position, to our position, we can actually attain perfection of our lives. If we have our own agenda, if we have our own interest, self-interest to enjoy life, we are like in the airplanes, they have something called the black box. They have something called the black box, which every pilot is aware of. This black box is a storehouse of all the information or the records of the plane. It tells you the altitude, it tells you which direction you're going in, it tells you everything. So when there's a plane crash, the first thing that the investigating team goes to look out for is this black box. They go and try to find the black box on the plane. And when they find the black box, then they can actually trace out why the accident happened, what are the cause, and so many things. So in all of our lives, we also have a black box. And the black box is actually the agendas that we carry in our lives. Black box represents all the desires that we have in our lives. It represents all the self-interest that we have in our lives. So if we have a black box that is filled with information that indicates that we have our own specific agendas in this world, and according to the data that is found in the black box, we get our next life. Our next destination is determined. So the black box of our life actually determines what we are going to be in the future. So Arjuna, interestingly, he had this ability to analyze the past, the present, the future, and the post-future. So all of us, if we actually want to know what is the purpose of our life, and if we actually want to have some meaning and purpose in life, we need to explore what is the content of our black box. And the content of our black box is stored in our ego, in the form of desires to enjoy in different ways. So if we transform of each, or if we dovetail all our desires to enjoy in relationship with God, then actually we can get perfection of our lives. Then our black box will always remain empty. Our black box will always remain empty. So I'll just end with a small analogy to understand how we can actually relate this whole thing in our lives. Just like the gopis of Vrindavan, they were praying to Krishna. They used to meditate. And what was the purpose of their meditation? The purpose of their meditation was that somehow or the other, I want to forget Krishna. Somehow or the other, we want to not remember Krishna. Because in every aspect, whatever they were doing, they were seeing Krishna. And because Krishna was in front of them, there was always a disturbance. So they decided to meditate and try to remove Krishna from their minds. So ours is, of course, the opposite situation. We need to meditate to pull Krishna into our minds. So interestingly, the understanding is that when we see candles, you know, wax, made of wax, to put color in the candle, you need to melt the candle. You can't color the candle just by dipping it in some color. You can't paint it. You need to melt it and then mix color into that in the mold and then mold it back. And when actually you melt it and mix color and then make it back, the color can never be removed. So God in our lives should be like that color. For the gopis, Krishna was that color and their hearts were melted. And when their hearts were melted, Krishna could enter and be all pervading. See, if all of us actually want to access God, we need to practice a life. We need to live a lifestyle which is God-centric. And we need to allow God to melt our hearts through the process of chanting of the holy names and through following the principles. When actually Krishna mixes in our heart, then he will never leave. There is a reason, I'll just end with this, why Krishna is having the shape, you know. very peculiar shape. You never find anybody standing in this pose. You know, three form, three bending, tribhanga roop, which is glorified so much. And there is a very interesting reason why Krishna assumes that particular form. The acharyas explained that anything that is straight, even if there is a small gap, it can come out. You know, like this hundi box. You know, if the hole is big and it's a straight hole, you can put your finger and remove anything from it. But if the object that is inside the box is bent, especially in three forms, then it doesn't come out easily. So Krishna, once he enters our heart, he assumes a three-bending form. So even if we want to remove Krishna out of our heart, we'll not be able to do it because he gets stuck. Right? So all of us have to conclude with, all of us understanding that the modes of material nature are existing and which are the cause of our living in this world, still understanding the fact that Krishna is above the modes and Krishna is the person who has actually allowed us to come into this world, we understand and we experience hope, that there is hope for us. And when we live a lifestyle based on that hope, when we live a lifestyle based on that, on the principle, then we experience a transformative change. And then Krishna never leaves our heart. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna. Somebody has any questions or comments you can take? Can end here. Grantra Srimad Bhagavad Gita ki, Srila Prabhupada ki. Thank you.